Good. So today is March 25th, 2015. I'm Rick Hansen. And what I'd like to do is to connect some of the topics that we've been exploring in here with a little teaching from the Buddha in the Dhammapada and do a kind of inquiry with you. You know, if you've been here recently, we've covered a lot of ground. I mean, last week, I think I said something like, I want to connect attachment theory, the phenomenology of experience, and how to be an awesome person toward others, you know? So it was a lot of stuff, and I thought we got to slow it down. So I want to read you this very short passage, four brief lines, as best we know, from the Buddha. This is from the Dhammapada. And kind of slow it down and unpack it, and especially apply it to practice. Right? So the passage reads, "Wonderful it is to train the mind, so swiftly moving, seizing whatever it wants. Good it is to have a well-trained mind, for a well-trained mind brings happiness." So it's a deceptively simple passage. And I want to kind of slow it down a little bit and unpack it. By the way, I get this, and you might like to get these as well, from an organization called Pariyatti, which will freely send you daily a very short quotation from the Buddha, much like this one. It's kind of nice to get it in your inbox. And sometimes I think of it for myself as like a kind of theme for the day. You know, there you are at the Chinese restaurant, they bring you the fortune cookie, and you kind of ask yourself a question maybe before you crack it open. And sometimes the answer is ridiculous or it's just not related at all, but often you think, oh, that's interesting. That has some wisdom for me. So, Pariyatti, P-A-R-I-Y-A-T-T-I, all right? Anyway, so let's slow it down. Wonderful it is to train the mind. Wonderful. How often do we think about practice and the opportunity to practice, which is what we're engaged in here, as wonderful, rather than a grim, dutiful slog? With, right? Wonderful. It's like, all right. Right? Not that bad, but okay. But the idea of wonderful. And then we have the notion of training the mind. Like, it's very interesting. Do you think that what you're doing here is training your mind? When you practice or when you exercise restraint or benevolence toward others, compassion or kindness for others, or when you manage anger, let's say, without poisoning yourself and others with it, whatever. Do you think of that, or meditate, or do yoga, or various other practices you might do, maybe a moment of gratitude at a meal? Do you think of that as training your mind? The Buddha did. He thought of it very much as a path of training, a progressive path of training. That's a really interesting notion, isn't it? I was in a workshop once where a Zen teacher came in and talked about, it was Yvonne Rand from Goat in the Road Sangha in Muir Beach, which I think is a lovely title, Goat in the Road. Anyway, a lot with that. But anyway, she said, yeah, in the mind trainings, I'm like, really? I'm there to train my mind? What an interesting notion. So what happens when you think about training the mind? So I'll hit a couple other high points and then I'll go back through them sort of slowly and see what you make of these. Maybe you have a question or a comment about them. So, wonderful it is to train the mind, so swiftly moving, seizing whatever it wants. Wow. So swiftly moving. Doesn't it feel like that? Attention jiggles around, so many things appearing in the mind, darting here and there. You know, there's a little image, your attention goes to it, and next thing you know, you're like falling in love with that person's left knee or something, and what? And then you pull out, and only 3 seconds have clocked by. The refresh rate, you know, like a monitor or a screen, in the old days would kind of have this refresh rate. You know, the refresh rate, basically, of the mind-brain system is about 6 times per second. If you kind of notice that, it's like almost like that. Roughly, you know, you can be aware of certainly at least 2 things happening in your mind in a second, often 3 or 4 or 5. A lot of stuff's happening, swiftly moving, right? And then, of course, we have seizing, grasping or fighting away, you know, or clinging to, seizing whatever it wants. So we have this fundamental dynamic of desire right at the heart of things. That was the Buddha's focus, was about wholesome and unwholesome relationships fundamentally to desire. You know, he anticipated Freud, in effect, by 2,500 years. You know, Freud focused on passion, desire, and all the rest of that. He moved motivation to the center of psychology. Freud did a century ago. The Buddha moved motivation, especially conscious intention, deliberate intention, right to the center of spiritual practice 2,500 years ago, radically. That was a radical move in his time. So bringing it into your own mind, seizing. Can you feel the seizing quality?
Yes.
You know, yeah. The Buddha talked a lot about perception. You know, you hear a sound, and if you're at all interested in it, it's as if your attention is seizing that sound. Or you have a sight. It's very interesting. Walk through a mall, kind of as a mindfulness practice, letting your gaze bounce around. What does your attention seize? You know, this pretty sweater there, or maybe you're loaded on dishwashers because yours is falling apart. So anything, you wander through Sears, like, you know, what you notice are dishwashers, right? Seizing, or maybe especially other people, right? Or seizing what you think is happening inside their head related to you. Seizing on that viewpoint about you. Or, all right, you know, that viewpoint about you, whatever that might be. Seizing, seizing, seizing. It's kind of funny. Watch the news or whatever you're interested in. You know, attention seizes. I'm watching my wife, you know, scroll through shopping websites. She'll watch me scrolling through political blogs, you know, seizing, seizing, seizing. And the Buddha implicitly in here points out that the swiftly moving and the seizing is problematic, right? Because that's why we train the mind. Wonderful it is to train the mind because it's so swiftly moving, seizing whatever it wants. So we train the mind to deal with these properties of mind that it tends to be moving quickly, continually seizing. Good it is to have a well-trained mind, for a well-trained mind brings happiness. It doesn't bring merely the end of the bummer, the end of anxiety or anger or worry or frustration, jealousy, shame, and so forth. It brings happiness. Okay? It's a lot there, isn't it? You can see also the power of Dharma study. Taking a sentence, there's nothing mystical here, is there? It's purely psychological. It's really common sense, very close to our experience, very penetrating. And basically, you get to see for yourself what you think. It's very powerful to really kind of slow it down and pick one word or one phrase or one key idea. Like, wow, just observing for a while, the swiftly moving, impermanent, transient, you know, dynamic. You know, 1.1 trillion cells, 100 billion neurons just between your ears, as many neurons inside your head as stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Connected to each other on average at 5,000 points, synapses, each one of which is like a little microprocessor itself, very dynamic. The average synapse is recycled within at least 2 weeks, constantly deconstructing, reconstructing, ebbs and flows, currents of neurotransmitters, all kinds of stuff going on, you know? Really fast stuff. So swiftly moving. 500 trillion synapses inside your head. Like, wow, how many galaxies worth of stars is that? I'll have to do the math later. I'll come back and tell you next week. But anyway, someone will probably tell me right now. So my point, right, is like, wow, you could just zero in on one thing, like the swiftly movingness. And what's it like? I think in me, when I really tune into this rushing quality, it feels tiring and kind of tense and agitated and unnerving. And then we have the part about seizing whatever it wants. So let's slow it down for a little bit. And let's start with the swiftly moving seizing part, okay? Because that's kind of the Buddhist style. He lays out a problem, then he lays out a solution. The problem is swiftly moving and seizing, right? And the solution is a well-trained mind. And the fruit of the solution is happiness. So what do you observe in your own experience, or what questions or comments might you have about the swiftly moving quality of your own mind and its ongoing tendency to seize things? And why is the seizing part in particular problematic? Great.
We all have so many other things to do, for one.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if you happen to have to just find something on the computer, there's at least 50-50 chance that something else is going to grab you. And
right.
You are, and you say, wait a minute, I'm torn, I have to do this, oh, and the phone's ringing, I have an appointment.
Right. You seize this, but seizing this blocks you from having that, and then you want that, and right? I mean, the Tibetan metaphor for the mind, like you're saying, is it's a monkey in a tall tower with six windows. Right? Each window is a sense door. Hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and then inner mental objects. And the monkey is agitated because it runs to the hearing window and, well, I might be missing out on something at the smelling window. Oh, something over here. It's like running back and forth. That's the Tibetan metaphor, the little inner monkey. Doesn't your mind feel like that sometimes? Right? So that's part of the problem with the seizing, okay? Other comments on seizing? Yeah.
I actually find it intoxicating sometimes.
Uh-huh. You know?
And it's actually somewhat pleasurable if the thoughts are good.
So he says it's pleasurable if the thoughts are good.
But of course, I don't have that much control. Yeah. So that when it tips over and unpleasant things.
Yeah.
But it's really problematic.
Yeah, it is fun to fantasize about things or just mull or imagine or work your way through solving a problem. That's really true. And I think that also goes to training. What's the difference between a well-trained mind that does have the innate nature of continually essentializing objects of cognition? That's how cognition proceeds. You know, the brain is continually trying to stabilize patterns in an underlying field of profound instability and dynamism. And it has to do that until you know, we stop, the brain stops functioning, usually several minutes after you stop breathing, as the lights slowly go out and the last bit of metabolic supplies are consumed, which is quite extraordinary to imagine. You know, as the lights gradually go out in the mansion of the mind, there's still the possibility of learning, consciousness, and so forth. But in any case, how do we do this? All right. Other observations about the seizing, the endlessly racing, please.
I'm remembering what you said a few weeks ago about just, and I become more aware of paying attention to what is grasping my attention.
Yeah.
And I also have the good fortune of starting my day sitting in a hot tub listening to the birds. I love it here. I moved out from the East Coast recently. And we didn't do that in Boston much. So what happens is I go from my house out to the hot tub, and it's so quiet. And then after sitting and meditating in the hot tub for 10 minutes, there's a racket going on. There's a rooster, there's all these birds, there's birds fighting, there's birds mating, it's just a racket. And I become so aware, you know, I've been paying attention to just life and what's grasping my attention, becoming kind of resentful of all these things that grasp my attention. Sometimes I'm grateful for, you know, traffic signs, but then when the birds grasp my attention, I just feel so lucky and so just really grateful, just lucky to be here. And you know, one of the reasons I love your neurobiological approach is, you know, I think, wow, why is it so hard to still my mind? But when you tell me how many trillions of things are going on,
it's a zoo in there.
It's a miracle. I get the birds.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful to the birds for just kind of pointing out to me just how flexible my mind is. And I also notice, with the grasping of attention, I'm a psychiatrist, so I pay attention to people's stories. And I'm so fascinated by how two people can be in the same situation and yeah. have just drastically different experiences. Yeah. And I love that. I love that reality has nothing to do with reality. So those are
Okay, very. Thank you very much. I think this kind of inquiry is really good. You know, we're engaging the teaching in a direct way. So a couple others. I see one, two, and then three in the back. Okay, so Lily. I think, so to say it so you all heard it, what do we do with multitasking? And my own view about that is that this question actually can take us into a deep place. And I'll try to say it really succinctly, and we can talk more about it. At one level, it's interesting to ask ourselves, hunter-gatherers, or if you go into the woods, like whether it's maybe in your hot tub, you know, near the birds, or just you go out into nature, just walk around, isn't it interesting what almost always really happens? We kind of settle down and get quieter. And maybe you imagine just walking in the woods or just kind of hanging out, and also imagining from that what the mind of our hunter-gatherer ancestors was like a lot, was mainly like. And let's remember that, you know, agriculture roughly came in around 10,000 years ago. Right? Modern humans roughly arose 150,000 years. Our hominid ancestors started making tools around 2.5 million years ago. So if you just mark it from the last 150,000 years, this current, writing essentially came in around 5,000 years ago. So basically, roughly 1/30th of the lifespan of our human species has been involved with symbol processing, let alone the more recent advent of the Industrial Revolution and the modern media-saturated society. So it's really new. Okay, why is it that when you're in the woods, I'll say it like this, why is it that when you're sitting at your desk and your phone is going off, messages are coming in, that little number is getting bigger and bigger in your email inbox, right? And other people are coming by and things are happening and horns are going off, that it's jarring. But when you're in nature, the bird chirps here, the bird chirps there, you hear the sound of the wind surging and passing away, there's continually change. It doesn't feel so distressing. And I think it's because when we're in nature, we have this experience of, as it were, being in everything. So whatever happens is part of a total gestalt that's already established, a whole. There's a wholeness there, right? That really relates to our, we feel embodied, we're in our body. There's a whole. In the whole, there's a lot of detail that's changing, but it's inside a whole. Whereas when we're doing things with emails and pagers and messages and all the rest of that, so our social media feed is continually changing, we're getting tweeted, the whole deal, whatever. It doesn't feel like it's part of a whole. It feels jab, jerk, pull, thrust. And it's very jarring. And it's really bad for us. It's not our way. We can tolerate, we can do it, it can be kind of exhilarating briefly, but it's really quite stressful. And actually, I liken it to feeling the way I was doing it a moment ago, like you're a marionette, a puppet. And we are being, you know, demanded, as it were, one thing after another, jerking us this way and that. And it's really quite powerful, I think, to appreciate that so many of the things that tug us this way, pull us that way, are controlling us for their own agendas. Right?
Yes.
That's their agenda that's doing that. And we have this sense sometimes of like, we've got to respond to the demand. But actually, that is a loss of personal autonomy and freedom. And it gives too much power outside. I'm not saying to shut the doors, and sometimes we have to do it, but I think a kind of, in my opinion, disenchanted, clear-eyed view of the agendas of the demands coming at us continually is really useful. And an insistence upon your own entitlement, you know, to a certain buffer where you get to decide how you're going to respond, you know. That's part one. Part two for me, and this I think goes to a truly well-trained mind, is to be able increasingly to experience modern society. I think like our great-grandparents experienced being in the woods as one whole field, you know, in which things happen. People call us, emails arrive, sounds appear, fire engines go by, but it's one whole experience. And a lot of what we do in practice is to train in, frankly, neural substrates, neural circuits in the brain that take us more into gestalt awareness, you know, experience as a whole. So we feel more and more, and we start having sometimes very penetrating, the bottom falling out glimpses into this, we feel more and more that we're kind of everything. You know, Dogen, the great Zen teacher, said to study the way, to do particularly the way being the Buddhist way, but you could apply it to other paths that have a profundity to them, I think. To study the way is to study the self, the apparent self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. We open out into. And in that frame, then, it's just another email. It's just another tug. And it's not so much that attention is jerked from this to that. It's more like attention is stably present in the whole field in which one thing or another is arising, and there's a kind of inner freedom and autonomy in our response, an appropriate response to whatever's there. That's a well-trained mind. And we practice to stabilize it. You know, it's fairly straightforward to stabilize it in here for moments, right? And then in practice, as I think Upandita put it, it's to expand the range of experiences in which we're free. You know, to be free in an experience in which someone is suddenly coming at us demanding something, or, you know, something didn't work, or, you know, there you are, there my wife and I were last night trying to watch an episode of Justified. It's a confession, I admit it. Second season, it was a good season anyway. And so there we are, we're getting it streaming from Amazon, Amazon Prime, and these are, we call these first world problems. And suddenly, it stopped cold. And it just, we didn't have enough bandwidth. And you're pushing the button, and bandwidth. And you go through all these steps, and you can't get out of it, and you're trapped in the endless loop, so you turn the power off or everything, and you start over. And you know what I mean, blah, blah, blah. I'm making fun of myself about it. But to be able to be in that kind of situation, let alone more serious situations, in which there's a freedom in the midst of that experience, that's a well-trained mind.
One of my favorite sayings always was, show me somebody who spends all their time putting out fires, and I'll show you a pyromaniac.
There you are. That's good. Thank you.
That always stopped me in my tracks whenever I would.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's right. Thank you. Okay, we have a couple more people, then we'll move a little further and wrap her up. Yeah.
Thanks so much. So lately I've had monkey mind, a lot of monkey mind, and I'm not usually that way. So, and I still have been doing a ton of metta and
loving kindness practice.
Loving kindness, but I've been having the flip side of metta, which is getting pissed off a lot.
Anti-metta. Anti-matter. Anti-metta. Auntie, right, uncle, I don't know what, uncle something, auntie metta, okay.
Yeah. Lots of family anti-metta. And what's been helping me a little bit, and I wonder if you're going to talk about it next, is my favorite third foundation of mindfulness these days, and hiking with the dog, and slowly I starts to slow down, and then I see, following, naming, doing all the things that you're supposed to do for the foundation of mindfulness, which is really helpful. So I'm wondering if you can address that and how that plays into it, and what if that's because there's a space between all the monkey mind
right. Where
you're not even thinking about that yet. And so how do you get from where you're monkey mind, and then you're to the place, I don't know where it happens, but somewhere along the line I go, oh, my mind is flipping out, you know, and then I start to follow. follow it, and I'm wondering how you get there quicker. It seems like it's happening quicker, but I wonder if you have any insight into making me remember to be mindful sooner.
Right, there you are. Well, a couple of things. So what you're talking about, just to make sure everybody's, we're all kind of together, is being aware of, you know, just the feeling in the body, actually, moment to moment. Am I getting caught up in seizing and tension, you know, various forms of craving, chasing what's pleasant, fighting what's unpleasant, clinging to what's heartfelt, wanting things that are neutral to hurry up and get better quick, you know, et cetera, right? Or whether you have a mind that's relatively peaceful and contented and loving, right? And awake and alert and collected, right? Okay, and a couple things. First, I think it helps overall to slow down the mind and to practice more with tranquility and to be aware of the gratifications in accelerating. You can feel it, can't you? I'm very in that world of accelerating, like speeding up. Get that done. And there's kind of an initial rush to it. But I think of this line from the Buddha about anger, it seems to apply here. Anger with its honeyed barb and poisoned tip. You know, honey in the front end, poison in the back end. And I think there's a lot about accelerating that has that. It feels kind of like a rush. It's exciting. It's enthusiastic. Has passion to it. Technically, you're getting a rise of activation, the sympathetic wing of the nervous system. And there's initially kind of a, ah, and can feel like a high, and it can become very habitual, right? And then also if you have a temperament, like me, I'm probably a fairly quick accelerator, you know? Some people are really quick. They're more toward the spirited ADHD end of the spectrum. Other people are slower. But right on the heels of that acceleratedness is the long-term impact of cortisol, the stress hormone that is released when we accelerate. Even when we accelerate with positive emotion, you know, there is that cortisol, and cortisol takes a long time to metabolize out of the body. And it gradually accumulates what's called allostatic load, which wears on us. So one thing for sure is to move more, because our ancestors did experience cortisol, but they walked around more. The average hunter-gatherer walks, that ballpark is 10 miles a day, just in everyday life, you know. It's not that they're getting on the treadmill for half an hour, you know, and clocked, you know, whatever, a mile and a half there. There or more, you know, they're just moving around. So we don't tend to do that. So we either need to move more or have less cortisol. You know, move more or accelerate less or die young, right? Basically, that's kind of the choice in a nutshell, being straight about it. So that's one thing, is to really do practices of tranquility. And I don't think it's an accident that so many practices of spiritual traditions around the world involve tranquility, like a vision quest. You know, Native American, let's say, you put a circle of stones, commonly done, you stay inside that circle. Maybe you go outside to take care of bodily excretions, but inside that circle, that's where you are. Not much going on. It's very tranquil. And in that, lots and lots of things can happen. So that's one thing to overall try to slow it down. And I really do that. Second is to pause. As soon as you notice that you're getting contracted or pressured or moving into irritability or anxiety, fight or flight, right? Irritability, anxiety. Little alarm bells should go off. If at all possible, slow it down. If you're steering your way out of a skid on an icy road in Boston, okay, don't slow it down. But as soon as possible, slow it down. Buy yourself that time. Claim your autonomy. Claim your own buffer. I get to have this little space here. Tara Brach calls the sacred pause. I think that's really important. And then another thing is routinely practice this allness perspective, you know, opening out into everything, getting a sense of things as a whole. There are a couple things that really help. One is lifting your eyes to the horizon or above. It's a simple trick. Why is it that so often traditionally, you know, people who, saints, sages, whatever, are shown looking up to the heavens or up above? It's because when we look close, it becomes very self-referential. Friend or foe, up close, right? Opportunity or threat, up close. Whereas when we look out, like down the highway when you're driving, instead of the first 10 feet in front of you, or above the horizon line, that activates networks in your brain, literally, that look at things as a whole. Okay? So that's very powerful. Just take a breath. Look, people talk about it. Look at the far corner of the room. That's very useful. Just, it makes you look up to the far corner of the room, whatever that is. Or look out a window, right? Or just imagine in your mind, like a bird's eye view, a panoramic perspective. All these things will pull you out of this seized and often seized up sort of mind to a sense of things as a whole. That's a really powerful method. And then it becomes more and more habitual for you. You repeatedly internalize the sense of this, and it's more and more how you are, especially in a widening range of challenging experiences. Another is feel your body as a whole. That's really powerful as well, just even right now. Do you have a sense of like the surface of your skin as a whole, the whole skin bag, as Alan Watts put it? Just breathing, aware of all the sensations of breathing at once as a single experience. And just training in that makes it easier and easier to stabilize this sense of experience as a whole and not be agitated or seized up around one part of it. That really helps me. Okay. One more person, and another, then we'll move on.
So there are a lot of brain training programs out now.
Yeah.
Preserving mental function as you age. And to me, they all seem like they're not slowing the brain down. The purpose of them is to actually sort of speed up function or continue making more circuits or make them faster. Can you speak to how that relates to what you're talking about?
It's very interesting. Things like Lumosity or others, as we age, we tend to, you know, increase in certain aspects of intelligence and deteriorate in others, especially processing speed and perceptual acuity. Those are the two big ones, typically. So as people age, and these products are usually dedicated toward an aging group of the population, you know, there's something to be said for increasing reaction speed or the ability to shift awareness from this to that fairly rapidly. You know, there's a place for that. And if you actually can be at cause about the accelerating process or this, you know, the mind so swiftly moving, then you get more control over it on the one hand, you know. On the other hand, I think a lot, you know, it kind of depends on your intention fundamentally. And it's like, what do we really want? You know, there you are looking back. You know, this is a very powerful practice in terms of motivation. Imagine there you are toward the end of your life. You're still happy and comfortable and out of pain, but you're sitting on the porch looking back on your life, you know, looking back on the road that you walked. And very few people, I think, sitting in that porch would think to themselves, darn, I wish I had sped up more. You know, I wish I had clung to more things. I wish I had craved more thoroughly, you know, right? I think most people would say, basically, I'm really glad for the love I gave and the love I got, you know. I'm really glad for moments of awe and magnificence and fullness, and I'm really glad for the fruits of my practice here in terms of serenity, you know, and peace and an untroubled mind. Really, that's what I'm really glad about. And so I think, you know, we live in a society where arguably the greatest minds of our generation are continually fanning the flames of desire for their own agendas, mm-hmm. right? One thing or another. And I live in the world of ever more sophisticated pitches. It's almost an art form. These people trying to trick you mm-hmm. into, you know, giving you them your credit card or getting you to click this link, which leads to that link, which leads to that link, which next thing you know, leads to that $999 personal transformation, superhuman consciousness online seminar. Like, what? You know? And I don't know about you, but I have a certain, it's not for me. So I want to conclude with a traditional recommendation in terms of training the mind, and you might ask yourself where you are in terms of this sequence. And the traditional recommendation has just three parts to it. It's very practical, very concrete. Just like the practical suggestions I gave there, you know, slow it down, demand the autonomy that you're entitled to decide what your response will be to the demands of the world, okay? Panoramic perspective, eyes to the horizon line or above, and practice experiencing as a whole. Very practical things. Additionally, in terms of training the mind, how do we train the mind? Three steps. Know the mind. So we investigate it. We slow things down enough, or we just sit quietly long enough to watch the whole show, right? And then we start penetrating into it more and more acutely. Or we start understanding, wow, you know, knowing my mind, I have a lot of unfulfilled longings from my childhood that are really driving a lot of this seizing that I'm doing, right? Including seizing on my views or my defenses to push away the longings that led to pain when I was young and yet are important to honor today. Right? Many kinds of seizing. Many forms of attachment, attachment to view, to pleasure or the end of pain, or to the sense of self, or to routines, rituals of various kinds, right? So we know the mind. We observe that. We see what happens. You watch your mind when suddenly Amazon, damn it, is not delivering the show. What's going to happen to poor, what's the guy's name? Anyway. Right? Yeah. Know the mind. That's cool. Right? Two, shape the mind. Shape it. Train it. Cultivate restraint. Cultivate loving kindness, happiness, inner peace, self-respect, sense of dignity. You know, those practices I did at the very beginning when we were meditating, I think it's very important that, you know, kind of upright, dignified, in a good sense, not an uptight dignity, but a sense of self-respect, a confidence in your own good heart, in your own natural goodness, that you don't need to apologize for to any human, right? A sense like that, a kind of inner nobility in this sense. And these are various kinds of shapings of the mind. Shape the mind so that your mind, like I think the great teachers, is increasingly rested in a sense of just being a momentary rippling through allness, now and now and now, through this local point. And then, third, free the mind. Wow, free the mind. What in the world does that mean? Free the mind, right? I think it means a kind of living in the now, continually letting go with a kind of inner freedom. You know, that again characterizes people who are really far along. You just observe it about them. They're very spontaneous. There's a real freedom. There's an appropriateness, but they're not bound. People come at them with a weird question, and they just kind of laugh and go the other way. I remember watching Barbara Walters try to interview the Dalai Lama in her clever, I mean, she's good-hearted in her clever way, and he's just like totally free. Like, I don't have to presume your premise, right? I don't have to assume what you're saying here is true. It's like that. Not disrespectful, but an inner freedom. Free the mind, I think that's one aspect of it. Another is to kind of get a sense of, you know, mind really is just, like I'm saying, it's this kind of local ripple through the whole thing. The allness of the universe, you know, rested in what's unconditioned, always just before things appear. Or maybe for you, freeing the mind has to do with a kind of falling out into the divine, opening out into everything. You know, there's this fantastic haiku, I'll leave you with this, right? From memory, it's something like, and it's a true story, it was an awakening haiku. Like after this person went through this and popped out into Satori, they wrote a haiku about it. And I think it's like this. Water in a bucket, spring moon, okay, the bottom falls out. Let's sit with that for a minute. know the mind. Shape the mind. Free the mind. Thank you very much. See you next week.